welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Transitioning in from my new webmaster on the text. That's very high stress for me, Kimball. And I am just not good at this, but the website hasn't really been fully functional since mid-October. And you know how my site is. It needs to be that atomic-powered tank.
Well, to keep up with you, yes, absolutely. But I hope you found the right person for the job.
Yeah, that sounds like a metaphor for all the different facets of life, doesn't it? But I hope so, too. I mean, part of it is that I am just so ignorant. You think, like, expert guy on everything out there would be able to, like, not send text like, you mean it's up on one of them clouds, right? And and I'm sure, like, get laughed at by the person on the other end. So there it is.
Well, yeah, I've never asked you this before. I assume you do your writing on a computer, or are you old-school typewriter guy?
I'm not an old-school typewriter guy, but I was watching an episode of Columbo the other night with that guy from, he was in the Twilight Zone, that bus stop episode, and then he was in Adam 12. You know the guy I'm talking about, right? The blonde guy.
Oh, Martin Milner?
Yeah, he was on it, and he was a writer. And he was on this typewriter of, like, olden times. And the thing was so, like, it was so loud. And I'm a very violent striker of the of the keyboard. I'm kind of like Beethoven there with one of those late sonatas going away. And sometimes I even, like, cut myself if I go so hard. But, Kimball, if you saw me type, you would think this man is a virtuoso of typing. You'll never see speed like me at that keyboard.
See, I go pretty fast, but a brief story here. My mom gave me an old typewriter when I was 5 years old. And so I learned to type very fast, but not in the appropriate way. And in later years, when I was taking typing in high school, I had a typing teacher say, "You're looking at the keys." I said, "I am, but I'm doing about 80 words a minute with virtually no mistakes." And then
when I took a typing class in high school, I think early in high school, did they still give those?
I think they've transitioned into keyboarding and other computer pursuits.
But it was, I remember walking around after that, like going to hockey games or whatever it was, and I would just type everything in my head so I could, like, see it with the imaginary head fingers I had. And if I didn't type like I do, it would have meant I'd be a completely different writer than I am. I mean, so much of that is in that musicality of typing at the computer. But when you mention the typewriter, you'll notice when you read, like, those token MFA stories, there's, like, this typewriter rhythm to them. It goes da-dun, 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 ching, da-dun, 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 ching. And it's like this kind of rote, automated rhythm. And I was watching Martin Milner the other night, and it's like, huh, he has that rhythm going. He was this mystery writer in this. I also noticed, too, you ever notice that Columbo doesn't show up until, like, halfway through his own show?
Well, Peter Falk had other things to do, I'm sure.
Yeah, he's gone for the first, like, 24 minutes. I'm thinking, like, what is this, like, some spinoff? They're trying to launch another series, and then he shows up. I was watching more of them. It's like, dude, you, like, barely come in before the first half hour is over. And then he goes off, and he comes back a bunch of times. He says, "One more question for you." I'm thinking, like, all right, well, you have this down to, like, utter deductive minimalism.
I wonder if they shot it like they did the old My Three Sons, where Fred McMurray would come in and shoot just his part in about 10 episodes in one day, and then say, "Oh, I'm up on the golf course. See you fellas in a couple of months."
That's such a great show, don't you think? My Three Sons, like, the sort of career arc that McMurray had, that he went from things like The Apartment and Double Indemnity, and he became really this, like, ultimate father figure. Like, he's kind of the dad that everyone hopes they have and that their dad measures up to and maybe even, like, surpasses by a little bit. But that's, like, the ultimate kind of dad as friend figure, I think. I mean, I love that show.
Oh, I did too. And even when there was turbulent times in the late 60s, things were still pretty 1950s in the Douglas house.
It rained, like, such a long time. It's always interesting, too, those shows that kind of, like, bridge that world between black and white and color. And another one is down there in Mayberry that we've talked about. Mm. And I don't know. It's like that of course is still on TV Land and whatnot, or MeTV rather, around here. I was watching that too, and it just, again, they just seem to hold up so well. There's this episode of Johnny Dollar where he's talking to the insurance guy who calls him up and sends him off on one of his investigations, and he meets this constable in Vermont, and the constable says, like, the world is changing, everything's changing, and Johnny Dollar says to him, "Except human nature." And it's like, really? So you see those shows where they're like ethos, that sort of key that makes them work is that human nature. And they really just don't, they don't age, as someone like Aeschylus could also tell us.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Chemistry and connection. What's the difference between the two?
I was supposed to have this really profound blog entry up before we talked about this, and I figured we'd kind of get into that, but it's in the draft, so that hasn't happened. But I've noticed lately that people will conflate the two words. Have you seen that?
Like,
people
yes.
use chemistry and connection interchangeably. And to me, you might as well use up and down or left and right as though you could just flip the terms, because they're so different from each other. And of course, because of my horrible tenure on the two dating websites that have yet to ban me, I meet a lot of people who talk about these two terms. And chemistry is something like rapport. And chemistry is great, but rapport is one of the most underrated ways we have of interacting with someone, successful ways we have interacting with someone. And you think about, like, times in your life when you've had a single conversation with someone, or just one lone phone call. I mean, you can tell rapport right away, right? Rapport is tempo, it's give and take, it's you're going to say this, they're going to pick up on it in a certain way, and they're going to come back with something else. It's like volley and serve, back and forth. And I should say this, you probably get this a lot too, people talk about our rapport.
Yeah, it's like a dance. We've learned each other's rhythm, but that happened fairly soon in our time together, and it doesn't happen with everybody. It's, I think, much more rare than connection.
You think that rapport is now, you see, I would say that the exact opposite is true, and I don't know if there's very much in this world that I would term as rare than connection. But it's interesting. If someone were to go back to the very first segment we did, which is up on my blog, which is my website, which is being repaired, you'd really kind of hear the same sort of thing that you hear right now. I mean, it's like an interesting little experiment. Like, the minuet is pretty much the same. It's like the same kind of tonal back and forth. Like, it's not like anybody really mismatching with each other. There's nothing like that happening right from the jump. And the connections the chemistry that I've denoted that I have with people, is always there just like that. And, like, people are so loath to use the phone. And back, like, 6 years ago when I'd go on the occasional date, I'd want to talk to somebody on the phone because I could tell right away if there was any chance for anything. Like, really within the first sentence, I could tell from the quality of their voice. I just knew. And sometimes you'd be like, well, you couldn't know. And just to kind of carry things through, I'd go out with the person. And then, like, I'm out there 15 minutes. I'm thinking, well, this sucks. This is very regrettable. I could be home watching, like, Belvedere. And you just want to flee, but you have to power through the 45 minutes. Whereas connection, I've only had in my entire life what I would call a real connection. And it wasn't with a family member. It wasn't with a friend or a former friend. It wasn't with a wife or a fiance. That's how rare I think connection is. And I think a lot of people live their entire lives without having a single connection. It doesn't mean you're partnered. It doesn't mean you're married. It doesn't mean you have kids. Connection is the twining of two people at the very essence of their soul.
All right. If you define it that way, then yeah, absolutely. That's more rare than just about anything out there.
That's ultimately what a story like City is about. And I think that's a big part of the resonance of that particular story, which is within this framework. If I wasn't blackballed, think like things would be going really well with the story, because the framework is of mass shootings. And within this story of mass shootings, this fiction story, there is this unique connection. And I think it's kind of like the ultimate story to point someone towards what is encapsulated. Not that you can even really encapsulate connection, because it's bigger than all outdoors, and yet it's shared between two people. And it is possessed of this roominess that it doesn't compromise one person's being. It doesn't say, like, okay, you're lesser for us to be this thing together. It's two people, too, who also hold up the mirror such that they can each see each other better for who they are and who they might in turn become, in part through each other and in part through other means of just being vulnerable in life and really, really going for it. Going for it is something that is underrated. Like, when you look at somebody like the Beatles, Paul McCartney, when Paul McCartney wrote Here, There, and Everywhere, he wrote Hey Jude, he was going for it. And then he stopped going for it once he left the Beatles. Now, that's a musical example, but connection requires you to be fully going for it with another person, but ultimately, too, in yourself and for yourself and for them.
Well, and this ties into some of what we've been talking about in our last few meetings together here on the airwaves, that social media certainly doesn't help with connections and often is a hindrance. And I think for a lot of people out there, they never make a connection with anyone. And that's why so many of us live those isolated lives that you've talked about recently.
Social media becomes this kind of ossification of our nerves, which have to be, if not exposed, then at least present in our interactions for us to have the chance of connection. And connection is so rich that it has multiple forms. It's not even just between people. You can have a connection with a work of art. You might be some angst-ridden 16-year-old who feels like you're being pushed around at school, and you come home and you put the homework aside and you sit on the bed and you put on the headphones and you turn up the Who's Quadrophenia and The Real Me, and you're connecting with a work of art. And Thoreau, especially as we read his journals, we see somebody connecting with nature to the degree that they're saying, I don't really believe in travel. Travel is not for me. Mastering where I am at and growing into everything I can be in that space is a different kind of travel. It's a more rarefied kind of travel. And I'd agree with that. Joyce would have agreed with that with Dublin and other people, too, that we can think of. But connection is, it's thwarted by the internet, because what we're doing is we're pulling back and we're putting out the bare minimum. And the bare minimum is often kind of like a stock phrase. And so you're trying to get those cheap plaudits that mean nothing. And you're encouraged in this because it's a strictly numerical count. People will look at their interaction and the success of their human interactions, which aren't even human interactions, they're much more bottish, by the tally of the likes. Now, I don't doubt that there are people out there, maybe there are a million people, who respond to my work in a more powerful way than they do someone else's work. But that report doesn't come back to me as of yet in terms of the likes. So what does that ultimately mean? What does that mean that the most published person in the world, for instance, has 150 Twitter followers? Like, it pretty much debunks the idea, right? That this is anything of any kind of barometer, indication, value, because here's the axiomatic proof in this one particular person.
Well, and there are people of great talent out there who disdain social media completely and seem to get by all right without worrying about the likes and the shares and any of that nonsense.
See, I don't think there are many people of great talent. I think that's what makes great talent what it is. But you bring to mind someone who made comments along this very subject this week, Charles Barkley. Well, I think he's a pretty smart guy, right? I think he's an entertaining person. I think he's someone who's always had a reasonable perspective on the world. He's seen friends that you don't have because you don't know him, and yet when you watch him, you can kind of pick up on the counsel that you would get from a friend. And he said that he would never do social media. And part of the reason he's saying that is because every single thing becomes twisted and potentially thrown back at you. Like, look at this horrible shooting in Colorado. Look at all of these people, these evil, vile people in my industry who could not wait to get out there and castigate white people, the villainization of white people, before they even knew who had, well, most likely to be legal about it, committed this particular atrocity. And then when confronted with the truth, it wasn't like, well, my bad, I shouldn't have had that reaction. I should take this as sort of like a learning lesson. They double down. And I just think the only way you can avoid people like that and avoid the backlash is to completely go out there and fling it, which is what I do. It doesn't mean like throwing around stupid opinions, but you have to 100% commit to a kind of truth. And then I guess part of that is also faith-based, that you think in doing this over time, it's going to pay off for you in the ways that we expect our faith to kind of be rewarded.
When you talk about truth, that leads us into the next phase of the conversation and the word fact, which is also misunderstood and misused on a fairly regular basis.
It's one of those words like literally. We've talked about how literally doesn't mean extra super duper really true. Fact has become, I really feel like the educational system would be better served by just sort of like these simple primers. Because you can do a lot with the word fact. Fact is often a numerical concept. It has that kind of empiricism to it, let us say. Like, for instance, it is not a fact that a second grade boy is a worse baseball player than Mike Trout. That's not a fact, right? I mean, it isn't. It's a truth. A truth pulls rank on a fact. But a fact would be, in 1987, Mark McGwire hit 49 home runs. That's a fact. See, it has that mathematical component to it. And you have preference, you have opinion, you have fact, and you have truth. Like, for instance, it is not a fact that William Shakespeare was a better writer than Daniel Steele. The truth. But you could say in the year 1599, William Shakespeare published this, this, and this. That would be a fact. It's very different.
So must a fact be measurable?
A fact has, I mean, it's confusing too in like detective shows, the whole like just the facts, ma'am. Oftentimes the just the facts aren't actually facts. Facts have like, he walked into the building at 5:03. You're on the camera. Like, yup, like that's a fact. A fact is like, normally a lot of mornings I go down to the corner and I get a bagel. Not a fact.
No.
It's just, yes, it's normally math-based. And now it's become, because we try to pull rank on each other in the arena of Twitter where we go for the my argument beats your argument type of thing. But we lack the vocabulary, we lack the cognitive skills, we lack the reason-making to be able to spar with other people and truly, like, vanquish them. So we sort of sputter and we exaggerate and we, like, try to use our words, which we don't have a lot of, for maximum effect. That's why you see all caps. I mean, is it possible for someone to write in all caps? I mean, maybe I'm offending people, but I really wouldn't imagine many of the listeners of this show are this way, and not be an absolute freaking moron. Like, is it? I mean, it kind of isn't, right? It's not a fact. Truth.
And finally, those people that seem to always be doing their very best. It's like those living their life to the fullest that we talked about recently. Who actually is doing their best out there?
Now, this came up because, and I've gotten quite a bit of this. So if you were in the hell space I am with these dating apps, and may that never happen to you, or anyone you care about, or your boy, anybody, hopefully never, you would see these profiles where you think, like, really? Like, you click on, like, their summary, and it just says, lol. But, I mean, come on. So it's like, you just, like, just the pictures. And the pictures will be like, she's in the bathing suit in one and a bathing suit in the other. And the whole profile is just like, I'll tell you later. I mean, so what are you supposed to say to this person? Now, in my novel that's coming out, I think next year Musings is Franklin, the perverted guy who dresses up as Ben Franklin. He would respond by saying, like, breasts look nice and full. But really, what are you supposed to say? There's nothing to say. And so I've sort of written this into my own profile summary, like that I'm really looking for someone with something to say and not like a three-word bio, because where are you supposed to go on? Well, people call me out for this. Like these defenders, like these, I don't know, like they're these maintainers of justice. They say, like, people are just doing their best, man. That's like, really? Do you really think people are going around, like, doing their best? Why do we have to make so many allowances and excuses for people? Because if I think you're doing your best when you only can write that, I'm doing you not just a great disservice, but I'm really insulting you, aren't I? Like, this is all this, like, moron, this gutter slug can manage. That's pretty insulting.
I've had students say that a time or two. I did my best. And I often will look at them and raise an eyebrow and say, I don't think I believe that. Do you believe that? And 9 times out of 10, actually 99 times out of 100, they'll say, okay, it's not really my best. No, it's not. No one gives their best.
At least with the student, like, maybe they've cheated with the margins, right? Or they've used a bigger font or whatever it is and not studied as hard as they could have. But they've at least, to some degree, gone through the motions. Like, you don't get a test that comes back in, and the test was, like, say, 25 questions, and they only answered the first one and told you they did their best, right? Like, they've gone through the motions of trying to make something up for all of the questions that Kimball, here's this guy this with his pop quizzes. He's a Attila the Hun of the history class. And they go through the motions of it, at least. This is like getting back a test where they've only sort of, like, put their first name, didn't bother with the last, didn't dot the one I, and then just said, what do you expect? I did my best. But worse, it's some kind of other person white knighting for those other people.
Yes.
It's like we kind of have to hold each other to a standard. Like, we've talked about this. I don't think there really are intelligent people. I think you make a choice to put certain things into your mind, to expose yourself to things. I know that the people that I know, they think and talk differently because they know me. It's exposure. It's what you're going to. We've talked about college. I didn't learn a single thing in college. I mean, I went out, and you can say, like, okay, devil's advocate, you're different. But everyone has their own degree of this. And when you go on something like a dating site, and it's also how it would be in the rest of your life, it's not just in the area of romance, and you've been jilted in love and nursed the broken heart. People just put not even the bare minimum. They just kind of, like, make it so, all right, technically there's, like, a character in the field. And then you're supposed to sit back and be like, good on you. Well done. It's like, come on. Let's get on the line. Let's do some sprints. Let's build up our lung capacity. Let's lay into the team that we're playing against on Friday. And just, we don't do that. We just say, let's just chill.
Do people think they're helping when they say to someone who clearly is not giving their best, you did your best, that's good enough?
And that's an interesting question, because I really do, I wonder about the motivation in saying that to me, because I am not someone who's just some draconian monster. I think I'm pretty ingratiating and affable. Now, I am not awesome at suffering fools. I mean, I think that's, like, probably pretty obvious, but I do nurse a certain degree of forbearance, and I do try to look out for my fellow human, even the ones who aren't looking out for me. But to me, this is part of that, because if we just take away the baseline, we're all in free fall, which we kind of are right now, and it's obviously not working, and I don't know why people can't connect these dots. It's Twitter, it's Netflix. It's the excuses, it's the self-victimization, the love of being able to proclaim victim status, the lack of accountability, the lack of passion, the whole emphasis on being chillax and whatever rot and rubbish. And it's not doing anyone any good. And someone comes along, and I think their motivation with me is they feel like they've done what is that sort of token good deed of the morrow. And it's not really actually a good deed. It's the same thing as posting something on Twitter with the sole expectation, not of making a difference in a single damn person's life, but to get the likes. Like, I posted something on Twitter today, it's a Charlie Patton song. And I thought, like, all of this bilge on Twitter, listen to this Charlie Patton song from 1934, which is quite honestly the best thing that's going to happen to you on Twitter today. All of the lip service of Black Lives Matter. Listen to this. Actually put some art into your life for 2 minutes and 30 seconds. And I think someone comes along to me and they have at me in a kind of passive-aggressive way, which is really what people enjoy. And I think it's sort of like their kind of moral purity moment of the morning.
Colin Fleming, check out his new and improved And in the process of getting even better, website, ColinFlemingLit.com. If you haven't yet, what's wrong with you? Get his latest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Colin, thank you, sir. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good, bye.